Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 2025 will be an important year for Charlotte's transit plan. Well, one of four of them. This is the year voters could decide on whether they are willing to pay an extra 1 cent in sales tax to support a transit expansion plan. And if they have that opportunity, it will mean that this was the year that the General Assembly agreed to allow a referendum for that tax to appear on the November ballot. But the clock is ticking. It takes time for lawmakers to take up legislation, and they won't take up anything until we decide exactly what our plan is. A lot of this falls to Charlotte City Council in collaboration with other entities in the region, including the Metropolitan Transit Commission. And this isn't the only thing that council will be dealing with this year. The cost of living in Charlotte, already unaffordable to many, is getting more so despite our best efforts. Homicides are rising, and as Mecklenburg County contemplates yet another property tax increase, can the city avoid following in their path? Oh, and did I mention it's a city council election year? We're going to talk about all of this and more with four members of Charlotte City Council. Dimple Ajmera chairs the Budget, Governance, and Intergovernmental Relations Committee. Ed Driggs is chair of the Transportation Planning and Development Committee. Victoria Watlington is chair of the Housing, Safety, and Community Committee. And Malcolm Graham is back with us. He's chair of the Jobs and Economic Development Committee. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. We need to turn them on. Thank you very much. Okay, do we have Ed?
I'm here.
Yay, Ed's on the phone. I'm going to start with you Good morning. I'm going to start with transit, Ed. We've been kicking around this transit plan now for years. It has changed considerably since those discussions began and has been pared down substantially over time. And much of that is due to the need to placate the legislature, which did not look kindly upon our plans. There are now four plans on the table. Even if we decide on the one that we send to Raleigh, and even if they say yes to allowing a sales tax referendum to be on the ballot, and even if voters say yes to that referendum, will any of these plans achieve the kinds of results that we claimed we needed when we formulated the original plan, which had five rail lines? I'll start with you, Ed. Go ahead.
To get public approval for a 1 cent sales tax, which would fund $20 billion in mobility investments. What the legislature said was you can't spend 80 to 90% of that money on rail. We want to see it distributed more evenly among all modes of transportation. So we're now pursuing 40% rail, 20% bus, and 40% for roads. I think we can achieve the purposes of the plan. In fact, personally, I believe that making a greater investment in roads is a good idea because a lot of people are not going to be right near a rail line. So we will do some of the rail projects, and we will have more road projects than we thought.
This plan has taken a long time to come to fruition. We're going to talk about another plan that's taken a long time to come to fruition a little bit later on. That's the Brooklyn Village plan. What has taken so long here? Because we put this together, I don't know, almost a decade ago. We knew that we had a transportation and infrastructure-friendly federal administration for the last 4 years, and very little movement that I could detect was going on. We've known forever that we need Raleigh to sign off on this, but there didn't seem to be a lot of urgency until recently in that. So what's taken so long?
Well, the half-cent sales tax that was passed in 98 was supposed to pay for a red line going north from Charlotte. And as it turned out, that wasn't possible because Norfolk Southern wouldn't make that right-of-way available. So the blue line was built. The northern towns were not happy at not getting the red line they expected. And therefore, we had an obstacle to pursuing a plan for years because of that deadlock. And then finally, Charlotte resolved that by buying the right-of-way from Norfolk Southern. That opened the door for meaningful talks. And from there, it's taken us about a year or so, but we've moved pretty swiftly to get where we are now.
As you said, the Norfolk Southern stymied the Red Line for a long time because they said they wouldn't allow our trains on their tracks. And then suddenly they said, okay, we'll sell you the right-of-way. We'll sell you the tracks. So we bought them. And Malcolm, you've said that there is no plan B if the legislature says no to allowing a referendum. And here's what you told reporters in December when talking about the city's transit eggs all being in one basket.
I'm cautiously optimistic, but boy, there's a lot of work that has to be done in a short period of time to accomplish it.
And that was about 2 months ago. We own the tracks. What happens, Malcolm, if we don't end up with a fundable plan?
Well, again, I'm still cautiously optimistic that the General Assembly will give us the authorization to move forward. I had a conversation last night with some corporate leaders who are helping us advance the plan in Raleigh, and they too seem to believe that we are in a good position. Senator Sawyer said this week that, as I know, I've served in the General Assembly for 10 years, that there's still hurdles to be cleared. I think we can clear those hurdles. The General Assembly is up, they're operating. The committee assignments have already been made. Bills are now moving through various committees. And I suspect that once we get the bill out of bill drafting, that's where it sits today, and we get it into a formal General Assembly committee, getting the leadership behind it, that we will be able to advance the bill. The Speaker of the House, as well as the President pro tem, will be in Charlotte, actually, on February 24th at the Alliance. So give us an opportunity to, again, remind them about the importance of the plan for the region, not the city of Charlotte, the importance of getting it done sooner than later. Again, I can attest being there for 10 years that things move slowly in Raleigh until you get the leadership behind it to advance it in a meaningful way. And so we're following the lead of our chairman, Mr. Driggs, working with our corporate leaders, certainly talking with our legislators to, again, articulate the importance of getting this legislation done for the region, not, again, for the city of Charlotte.
So Ed Driggs and Malcolm Graham artfully sidestepped the question, so I'll ask you the same question. What happens if the legislature says, no, we have no plan B, we own these tracks? What happens then?
If the legislature says, no, we have to work with available resources, which compared to what we're attempting are very limited. So we have maybe $50 billion per bond cycle for mobility improvements, we're going to be in a difficult place. But I agree with Mr. Graham. I think the legislature will look favorably on this, partly because after the events in Western North Carolina, I think they appreciate an effort by us to create revenue locally and not be looking for funds from the legislature. And they also appreciate that Mecklenburg County is a driver of growth in the entire state. So I'm optimistic, hopeful, optimistic that we will get it. If we didn't, we would try again in the following session, and it would take longer.
Dimple.
Yes, I recently listened to Joe Bruno's coverage where Senator Vicky Sawyer had said that she is facing some skepticism. And there are some roadblocks and challenges, especially with Republicans in the majority in Raleigh, where they are not in favor of raising taxes, especially after expanding our food and beverage tax. And so certainly I'm optimistic, but there is skepticism there are, that we have to acknowledge here. In terms of we don't have a plan B, so what happens to the right of way that we have purchased? Either we hold it or we sell it. There will be other rail aid companies that would be interested in buying it potentially, but Norfolk Southern has first right of refusal.
So I'm hearing optimism from Malcolm, and I'm hearing optimism from Ed. We lost an ally in Raleigh when Mecklenburg Republican John Bradford chose to run unsuccessfully for Congress, so he's not there anymore. And now, as Dimple Ashmera just mentioned, Senator Vicky Sawyer, who represents Mecklenburg County, North Mecklenburg County in the legislature, was iffy about the bill's chances early on, and she has not become more optimistic. She recently wrote in an email that the bill is, quote, a long way from being palatable to have enough votes to even get it to the floor. That was reported yesterday by Axios Charlotte. What does that tell you, Ed Driggs?
I have no illusions about the fact that there is a diversity of opinion. There are all kinds of tensions in the state legislature, rural and urban, partisan. So I think it's to be expected that it's going to be difficult. I'm still hopeful that the leadership have acknowledged in my conversations with them that Mecklenburg is a great driver of growth in North Carolina, and choking on mobility is not good for us or for the state.
There are four proposed plans on the table now, because we went back to the drawing board. All include the red line to Davidson, because we own the tracks now. All contain the silver line, but with different permutations of rail and rapid bus transit, and with different terminus points, depending upon which plan you're looking at. They're also offering differing plans for the expansion of the blue line, with some involving rapid transit for bus, I think, and also different permutations of the streetcar expansion. With what entity, City Council or Metropolitan Transit Commission, what entity will make the final decision on which of these plans will go to Raleigh?
That's an MTC vote, and that plan itself won't go to Raleigh. What's going to happen is Raleigh will look at the bill, a draft of which they have right now. The engineers and the staff are working on developing those options that you're talked about into a more complete plan that would make clearer to the public what it is that will happen if they approve the sales tax. And that doesn't require a further check-in with the legislature.
Does the city, I think you're on the Metropolitan Transit Commission. Am I right, Ed? Yes. And you're also
I'm not. Our representative there is Mayor Lyles, who chairs that.
Okay. Do you or Mayor Lyles have a preference of which of these four plans is ultimately chosen?
I think we're waiting still now for more analysis, engineering, cost estimates. So those options were put out there as a first cut of suggesting the kind of things we could do. It's going to take a couple of more months before we have ranked all the projects, have done an up-to-date financial analysis, and can start to make some real choices.
There was significant pushback to the plan that preceded this one because of a lack of a red line train to Davidson, because they've been paying taxes. They voted yes on the previous sales tax and felt they got nothing for their money. And Norfolk Southern stood in the way of us being able to put that train on those tracks. Well, now we own the tracks. That problem has been removed. The northern part of the county is on board, but none of these four plans takes into account the hopes and dreams of Matthews for the Silver Line to go there. And the mayor of Matthews, John Higdon, is opposed to bus rapid transit. He's been on the show several times. He says it doesn't work well anywhere in the country where it's being used. And he said he will not throw his support behind this plan. If you don't go to Raleigh with unanimous support from everybody involved in the region, what does that do to our chances of their giving us permission to put this referendum on the ballot? And I have less than a minute.
I talked to some leaders there, and they said they would still consider it. Understand, Matthews is disappointed, and it's clear why. But they represent 3% of the population of Mecklenburg County, and the leadership of all the other communities voted almost unanimously in favor of this plan. So I think the legislature perceives that the great majority of Mecklenburg County is behind the plan.
The town of Matthews has hired a lobbyist to go to Raleigh and talk about this with them. We're going to come back and talk about that. We'll also get into some other things that council is considering as we go through the hour, and things that they'll be dealing with in the year ahead. When we come back with Ed Driggs, Dimple Ashmera, Victoria Watlington, and Malcolm Graham. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to four committee chairs of Charlotte City Council about many of the things that council will be taking up this year. And we're starting with transit because we just can't talk enough about transit. Ed Driggs is here. He's the chair of the Transit Planning and Development Committee. Dimple Eshmera is chair of the Budget, Governance, and Intergovernmental Relations Committee. Victoria Watlington, chair of the Housing, Safety, and Community Committee, and Malcolm Graham, chair of the Jobs and Economic Development Committee. The town of Matthews, who wants the Silver Line and who is very much opposed, at least the leadership is, to any bus rapid transit in lieu of the Silver Line train, has hired a lobbyist to go to Republican lawmakers in Raleigh to talk about a number of issues, but transit, of course, is among them. We can assume that lobbyists will be trying to convince them that the Silver Line is a must. Without a loud and active voice of Charlotte's own in Raleigh on this, won't this just muck up the works? Or do we have that loud voice working for us now in Raleigh, Ed?
We are engaging on several levels with the General Assembly, business leaders, and there's some advocates of ours for us as well. So I think our story is well understood there. The legislature knows that we're in this situation because of their requirement that we cut back on rail spending. So I would be surprised if they agreed to put it back.
Are we getting any feedback from what they're hearing from lawmakers, these folks that are talking on our behalf? We know that we just talked about the fact that Vicki Sawyer is a little pessimistic about this. What kind of feedback are we getting?
I think it's mixed. I've talked to various people there. No question that there will be some opposition. And Chairman Sawyer is in a difficult position trying to advance this idea. And so I understand that she's cautious. But again, indications I've had suggest that there is an understanding that this is something important for the state. And that's why I'm hopeful that we can get it done.
And the public and go ahead, Malcolm, go ahead.
And Mike, she's doing her due diligence as a legislator. She's talking to the members of her caucus. She's talking to the minority party, the Democrats. She's talking to various leadership within the county, to our corporate leadership. She understands what's happening on the ground. And so as a good legislator, she's doing exactly what she should be doing. Reaching out to a wide variety of opinions, even those individuals that are in Matthews that oppose it because of the shortfall for what they're experiencing. And so having been there again, I understand the sausage making aspect of what she's trying to do. All indications though that this is moving in the right direction very slowly. But very optimistically.
So the public has been asked to chime in on all of this. I know you've held at least one public session to get feedback about these plans. What are you hearing from the average rank-and-file Charlottean or people in the region about this plan?
I don't think the public knows enough about the details of the plan to weigh in on particulars. I can tell you that many members of the community are tired of the traffic. And so my feeling is that if we offer them a solution and action on this issue, that they will be responsive to that. No question, though, that we have some selling to do. These tax referenda have been unsuccessful at times in other cities.
Yeah. Victoria.
Yeah, exactly what Ed was just alluding to. It really depends on who you ask. People have seen increases in their taxes over the last several years, so there's a sensitivity to it. When it comes to transit, people by and large have come to understand that a lot of these transit plans are economic development plans. We've seen what happened in South End. We've seen what happened going out to university. And so people get that it's not necessarily that the people who live alongside these future tracks are going to see the benefit of these rail lines. And so the question really becomes, how then do people who live here today get to benefit from this? And that may look like small business participation in the contracting side. That may look like being able to relocate to a place that will have a future law that will enable them to get to work, employers certainly are considering how does that enable them to purchase in our region in different areas and still have access to talent. So I think that people are clear that it's not necessarily about riding on the transit. It's about how it shapes our region going forward, and they want to make sure that that makes sense.
Dimple.
Yeah, so Mike, overall, I have heard positive feedback from residents who have attended public forum or those who have actually been watching this very closely. There are people who want more investments, especially in our roads. They want well-maintained roads. We all want safe sidewalks and pedestrian crossings. But then there is also a segment of people that are saying, you know, this is not the right time, especially consumer spending has gone up all-time high. Consumer debt is all-time high. Credit card debts are high. We are seeing a little bit of slowdown in our economy, and people are concerned about high taxes. So I guess ultimately it's our residents who will make that final decision whether they want this or not. Our responsibility is to put it on the referendum if our state legislators give us that authority.
Malcolm, I want to piggyback on something that Victoria Wadlington was just talking about, that, and that was economic development. The Blue Line turned out to be a major economic development tool, as well as a means of transportation. But Raleigh seems to view the need for our plan, whatever that plan ends up being, as one that's more focused on transportation, specifically on roads, but transportation as opposed to economic development. You're the chair of the Jobs and Economic Development Committee. I think you know the answer to this, but I'll ask it anyway. Which viewpoint is the most valid and the most valuable?
I think it's not either or from my perspective where I sit, Mike. I think it's both. I think as we plan the growth and development of the 15th largest city in the country, that's certainly how we get people back and forth to work in a manner where they could make those type of connectivities that Councilmember Wallentine talked about. It's extremely important. And as we grow the economic base of the city to create jobs, economic opportunities, to try to assure that our city is affordable, to increase opportunities for small businesses and minority businesses in general, economic development component is necessary, I believe. You see what happened in the South Boulevard as an example of economic growth, as well as the being able to connect people to jobs and where they live is extremely important. I think all these lines have the same opportunity to do so. Even the streetcar and down the Bailey-Ford Road corridor has a unique opportunity not only to provide a connectivity to places and within that corridor, but also to help us with the corridors of opportunities, the growth and development of the Bailey-Ford Road corridor, as well as in East Charlotte. And so I think it's both, Mike, providing the ability to connect people to jobs, as well as to grow the economy based on those local communities and those corridors.
Victoria Wadlington, you're the chair of the Housing Safety and Community Committee, and I want to ask you about something that City Manager Marcus Jones told council recently, that the passage of the transit tax to fund this is also a public safety issue. He linked it to a, quote, holistic quality of life approach that includes other things as well. Do you see his point? Do you believe that better transportation will lower our rising crime rate? And do you think voters will see it that way too?
I think that's a stretch, if I'm being honest. I think when you talk about what contributes to crime, an increase in offenders, an increase in potential victims, and so when we talk about densification of our city, which comes along with transit, you increase the opportunity for these kinds of things to occur. That said, getting people off the roads and onto transit does reduce the potential for fatalities along our roads. So like any other thing, if we manage it correctly, we can use it as a tool to improve safety in our region. But to say that that it is definitely a part of the plan and that's an expected outcome without making specific investment to ensure that that's an outcome, I think would be a little bit of an overstatement.
Dimple Lashmira.
Yes, when it comes to our safety, you know, we have to address the root cause. Transportation is certainly plays in part of our root cause, but workforce development, economic opportunities, after school programs. And that's what we talked about, Mike, just this past Monday. We talked about alternative violence program. That's what's going to help us tackle our crime rate.
And we're going to talk about all of that in a second after we get off of transit. And we'll be off of transit in just a moment, I promise you. Ed, when we talk about this transit plan, we tend to focus on the rail aspect of this because rail is sexy and that's what everybody wants or they say they want. But 40% of the money will go to rail, 20% to buses, 40% to roads. And not much has been said about these road improvements, except that money will go to the individual towns and municipalities to spend as they see fit, as I understand this. And some people have described it as a windfall for these areas. What kind of road improvements are we talking about should we pass this sales tax for transit?
So Charlotte's share of the road money would be about $108 million a year. And our staff, led by Ed McKinney, has done extensive work in identifying the needs, creating a catalog of road projects, and developing a process for prioritizing them. So, in fact, if you go online to the Strategic Mobility Plan and you do a search on that, you'll see a lot of detail about the work that's been done. The whole town has been broken up into districts, and the needs of each district are identified. So I think we're going to be able to communicate pretty clearly how the road money would be spent in Charlotte. I can't speak for the other towns.
But you're running out of time. I mean, it seems to me you have a lot of communicating to do between now and November. You have to get the legislature to get on board and get the ballot, get it on the ballot, et cetera. What is the timeline? I mean, November's 9 months away. A lot of things to do.
This is a concern of mine, Mike. I think we need to start promoting this plan. The thing is, we didn't want to do that. We don't want to do that without having the authority to offer the referendum. So we're in a bit of a tight spot that way. But we are thinking about kind of marketing. The interesting thing about this plan, to your earlier question, is there's something in it for everybody. So you do have economic development. You've got mobility. For the people in cars, the fact that other people are riding on trains or buses will ease their traffic. So we need to make everybody understand what their particular advantage is if they support the plan.
So recently, Andrew Dunn, who is a conservative political analyst and publisher of Longleaf Politics, wrote an opinion piece in The Observer saying that Charlotte's transit vision is, quote, ambitious and unworkable, and that it's time for a new approach. He says Republicans, and you're a Republican, Ed, so I'm asking you. He said Republicans should take control of the plan, fix it, and then take the credit. Of our plan, he suggested, Republicans in Raleigh have every reason to reject it outright. And since Republicans have the upper hand, they should approve a transit referendum on their own terms, which would include a board comprised of, quote, business leaders with actual infrastructure expertise, and key appointments should go to state lawmakers, not just the city and the county. Regional buy-in should be mandatory. What's your response?
There are a lot of opinions about this and how we should do it, and everybody's an expert. The plan that we've proposed does create a new authority, and that was part of what was discussed with members of the legislature. The governance of that authority includes three appointments other than the membership, i.e. the county and the city will have appointments, but there are also provisions for three state appointments. And I think this evolved from conversations with the leadership in the General Assembly. So I don't think we're that far off base. And you're going to hear a lot of opinions. We are trying to focus on creating some answers and delivering solutions.
But he does seem to be saying something that seems to be the attitude in Raleigh, that Raleigh knows best about this and many other things. What is that accurate?
Well, Raleigh knows best because Raleigh has the power, right? So what Raleigh thinks is what happens. And we've been dealing with that. We accept that. So we offered them a draft of a bill based on discussions that we had had with them. And they have the absolute opportunity to modify that language or not act on the bill, and we will have to live with what the decisions they make.
So we are. So we
I
are
don't know about the wisdom, but certainly at the end of the day, that's where the decision gets made.
We are looking for a 1 cent sales tax, 1 cent being tacked onto everything you buy. Should this go through, Dimple, you're the chair of the Budget Governance and Intergovernmental Relations Committee. Mecklenburg County is considering right now another property tax increase, one that was predicted when they kept their increase in the past low. We did too. Do you think the prospect of a county tax increase might deter voters from saying yes to the 1 cent sales tax increase for transit, should that come to pass?
Well, there is a possibility, Mike. But, you know, when I talk to residents, they are more concerned about just trying to make ends meet. High prices of eggs, property tax. So, but let me say this, the city does not plan to raise the property tax rate in fiscal year 2026. And if you look
at
our
But you know it's coming because at your recent meeting, Marcus Jones, the city manager, cautioned that rising costs related to growth, and we were always told that growth would pay for itself. Clearly, that's not true. But rising costs related to growth will likely mean future tax increases. And you may be able to hold the line this year. But he said, as the council asks for more, he'll need more money. Do you plan to ask for more?
Well, you know, budget is a balancing act, Mike. We have to balance city services with limited resources that we have. We got to make sure that when someone calls 911, that CMPD, our fire department, is able to respond within that very short time window. So we got to keep up with the city services demand. And at the same time, we are being very thoughtful of our limited resources that we have. So it is a balancing act, like I said, but you know, we are one of the lowest. Actually, when you look at all the cities in the state that has population of over 250,000, our city is the lowest in property tax rate. So that certainly speaks volume to our financial leadership, especially our budget staff.
But the question is that realistic? Because we held the line, I think, this year. We're not raising taxes this year. And you certainly don't want to raise taxes, I would think, in a city council election year on top of a county property tax increase, on top of a 1 cent sales tax increase for transit. But rising costs are a reality for everybody that's listening right now. That would add to them, those rising costs. But at some point, you're going to need the money. Are we just, I'm going to ask you to think about this during the break, because when we come back, I'll get an answer from you. Are we just holding off on the inevitable? We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to four committee chairs of council committees, Charlotte City Council committees. Ed Driggs is chair of the Transportation Planning and Development Committee. Dimple Eshmera, Government Budget, Governance, and Intergovernmental Relations. Victoria Watlington, Housing, Safety, and Community Committee. And Malcolm Graham with the Jobs and Economic Development Committee. So Marcus Jones, the city manager, wanted more of a tax increase the last time, and he held off at council's request. Now he's saying that council it's likely that we're going to need more money, particularly if council asks for more stuff. You don't want to do it this year because it's an election year and we're facing all those other things, but are we staving off the inevitable, Dimple? And if we do, everything costs more in the future. Is it going to be more of a whammy in the future?
So my... The reason we are not raising tax rate, it's not because it's an election year. We have not raised taxes in last 6 years, but only once. So, and rising cost is an issue for everyone. And the city of Charlotte is no exception to the rule. Our budget staff has found ways to create efficiencies through technology advances. They have continued to find ways to save money. to absorb the rising inflation and the cost. But at some point, when does that end, right?
Yeah.
Efficiencies, at some point, we are going to find all the inefficiencies that is there where we have to eventually pass the rising costs to our residents. People want new fire stations, police stations, safer roads, safer sidewalks, investments in our infrastructure, in our affordable housing, economic growth and opportunities in our small businesses. So all of that does require hefty investment.
So
and this, go ahead. When we look at tariffs, now we are looking at tariffs. So that also puts pressure, like steel and aluminum. So when we are looking at higher cost of building infrastructure, we have to eventually pass that cost to our residents. We can only absorb so much.
So, Ed, at this past Monday's council meeting, you said that it was important to avoid a tax increase, but you indicated that you were worried.
During this budget process, if we have some kind of alchemy that says that we can do it without a tax increase, you know, count me in, yes. But the question is how? And are we eroding any kind of fundamental services of the city in order not to have a tax increase?
So, Ed, you brought it up, so I'll ask your opinion. Are we eroding services? Are we avoiding what will eventually have to happen so that voters say yes to a transit tax?
So, Mike, I said last year that I thought we were setting the table for future tax increases. I have a concern about sending a message out to the public that we can accomplish all of these things and that there is no pain involved. And I should also explain, when we did the revaluation of the property, and then we reset the tax rate, which is a normal procedure after a revaluation. We did a revenue-neutral reset. But that didn't take into account inflation, i.e. we moved our tax proceeds back in nominal dollar terms to the same that we would have had under the old valuation, and we didn't get anything for inflation in that adjustment. And so we are actually seeing our real property tax proceeds decline as a result of that. So I'm just worried. You know, I see things like $100 million for affordable housing, which I think is a priority of the council. But I look at that amount and I say, okay, that's nice, but how are we paying for that? And what are we telling everybody about where that cost will be recognized? So I do believe that we're getting ourselves into a position where we're going to have to make tough choices in the future.
As Dimple said, we raised taxes last year for the first time in 6 years with some new revenues earmarked to pay for arts and culture grants, public safety, and capital improvements. And just this week, council voted to join the new arts plan. Victoria, you were one of two council members, along with Renee Johnson, who voted no on that plan. Why?
Sure. I think it ties into the conversation we're having about the budget. We understand that things are getting more expensive. With that, though, just like in our own households, we've got to sit down and take a strong look at our overall financial health. What are we spending on? What are we investing in? And is it giving us a net increase? And like you mentioned earlier, we understand that it's simply not true that growth pays for itself. That said, we've got to understand how to best invest in a way that will give as many of our residents part of the benefit of a growing city as we can. So as a part of that, as we think about arts and culture, as we think about becoming a Thursday through Sunday night city and how we think about increasing tourism and investing in tourism over the years, we've got to understand that arts and culture plays a role in tourism. And so we need to match that revenue with that purpose and to continue down the path that we are doing, taking property taxes to pay for arts and culture is concerning for me because we understand that we have rising prices in other areas.
So a little history. For years, the Arts and Science Council, which is a privately, an NGO, raised money very much like the United Way traditionally raised money through donations at work by workers to help the city's arts and culture scene grow. And it fell on hard times. It was the most successful, one of the most successful systems in the country like that, but it fell on hard times. And now, last year or a couple of years ago, the city had its own arts and culture plan that it came up with in 2023. Now it is joining a plan formulated by Foundation for the Carolinas and the Arts and Science Council. The city decided to split with the county on that funding, and now you're back in bed with these folks. What changed? How is this plan different?
Mike, it's not a different plan. We developed an arts and culture plan that guides the investment of our money, and we expect that this new ASCC will act in accordance with those same priorities.
Why do you believe that? If you didn't like what the ASC was doing in the first place, why do you think they're going to do anything differently this time?
It's not the old ASC. What has happened is the ASC has been absorbed by the Foundation for the Carolinas. It will have a new board. That new board will appoint creative people who will do the grant making. And so it's quite different. And what's special about this is the fact that the county and the city came together on this one, recognizing that arts are not just a tourism device, but in fact they have a lot to do with how the city is perceived, having a vibrant art scene, and also preserving the health of those major arts organizations that identify us as a world-class city. So that was the driver behind it, and as it became impossible for the ASC to raise that private money, the city thought, okay, more government money is needed, but we want to have more say in how it's used. So we're partnering with the county toward that purpose.
That seems relatively dangerous to me, and we're watching it unfold at the Kennedy Center in Washington, where Donald Trump has just appointed himself as the head of the Kennedy Center and intends to control programming there. Government has no business in the arts. When the city decided to adopt its own funding mechanism, council members, including you, Malcolm, pointed to having more control over our arts dollars and arts and the arts and tourism and development and making it an arts and tourism development tool. Ed just said it's not a tourism and development tool. What is it?
It's not only that, Mike. It's not only that.
It goes back to the connectivity or economic development. It's both, right? And having it now have a home at the Foundations of the Carolinas with appointment powers by the city council as well as the county commissioners. The foundation has a long, rich history of being able to not only distribute dollars, but to raise additional dollars. And we hope that they will do that as well to match other public dollars that we invest in it to, one, recognize the what I call the blue bloods, right? The large organization that has historically received public funding, but also those emerging artists and those creatives to really create an art atmosphere that goes beyond the boundaries of Uptown Charlotte. And so I am cautiously optimistic. Again, that's a key word for today for every topic that we do, because all of it has hurdles along the way, that we can really recreate an art scene in Charlotte that serves a purpose of, again, identifying Charlotte as a leading city in the country where people can come to for fine arts and entertainment, and at the same time, really acknowledge those creatives on the ground, artists, giving them an opportunity to express themselves and to showcase their talents throughout the city. So I think the vote that we took on Monday really was about establishing a platform, establishing a guiding principle, working with Mecklenburg County to achieve those results.
Temple.
Yeah, and part of the success, how do we measure it? It's how strong the membership that we have on the board. We will have an opportunity to appoint five individuals on behalf of the city, five from the county. So we got to make sure that this board has arts expertise, people that are that have connections in the arts and cultural sector. And we have some folks that are from the business community so that who can help us raise funds. So ultimately, I think the board will ultimately determine how successful and how sustainable this plan is moving forward.
So let's switch gears before we run out of time. Victoria Watlington, our city ended 2024 with 110 homicides. That's a 10% increase over the previous year. And we've been at or near 100 homicides per year since 2019. You're the chair of the city's Housing, Safety, and Community Committee, and the council began this year discussing crime. Are the underlying causes of crime something that can be addressed and are being addressed by a government entity, or is it deeper than that?
Obviously, it's deeper than that, right? And that's been the point of the conversation that we've been having for several years. We have a hopelessness problem. We have an economic development and workforce development problem. People, when they are not able to join the traditional workforce, they resort to other means. We understand that mental health challenges in our youth is skyrocketing over the last several years. We know that COVID increased the level of isolation, folks. We know that a transient city has impacts on communities. So even as we see the increased investment of corporate investors in our neighborhoods, that has very real social impacts as well. All of these things, including the moving away from faith communities within our country, we see that people lack those touch points that they generally have had to connect and to know and invest in each other. So those are things that are far beyond government. When we think about what government's role is, our role is, I believe, exactly what we've been implementing through the Safe Charlotte Plan in partnership with the county and in partnership with other nonprofits.
Let me ask about that, Victoria, because we have rising crime, we have rising homicide rates, and we've been putting a lot of investments into certain areas of the city to improve living conditions and to address pockets of poverty. But at the recent meeting, Ed Driggs, who was with us this morning, made this point when he was talking to CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings.
We have been talking about sort of dramatic initiatives, Safe Charlotte and so on, for 4 years at least. And we can't point to, big success.
So are we making a dent? If not, what are we missing? What else can be done, Victoria?
Sure. So as I was saying, beyond government, it's those social interactions. It's investing in male mentorship programs. When we talk about violence interruption, we're specifically addressing people who would otherwise continue within that cycle, and we would see an increase in recidivism with repeat violent offenders. Those are the things that we are doing, and it is happening on an individual level, and that's where it has to happen. When you think about government, government controls policy and systems. We can invest in additional law enforcement, which we are doing. We can invest in some of our workforce development programs, the hospital intervention programs, et cetera, et cetera. There is no substitute for knowing your neighbors, however. I do want to point out that though our homicide absolute numbers have gone up, as our city has increased to over 900,000 people, our per capita crime rate has in fact gone down. So that is one thing that we've got to address. You're going to see more absolute numbers as you increase people.
And there's also this problem of jurisdiction, because the city handles certain things, the county handles other things. I think the city runs the police department, but the district attorney's office is run by the county. They have 85 prosecutors, which is said to be low for a county of this size. Once again, it's a county organization. So does the city have any influence over how much money they get or how they are staffed? And if not, how does that impact our ability to reduce crime? Because the police can arrest people till Christmas, and if the DA doesn't have any people to prosecute, then you got nothing.
Exactly. One of the things that we've been doing, and we've had a number of successes, is going with the chief and with the district attorney to the General Assembly to advocate as part of our legislative agenda for additional resources. So that is one of the key things that we can do from a city standpoint as it relates to increasing the ability of the district attorney to enforce the law.
So housing, affordable housing, workforce housing has long been in short supply. Charlotte has done almost everything it could possibly think of doing to help maintain the supply and increase the supply. But the housing market here is tight. That's not a secret. Mm-hmm. Even those with money. And yesterday, the Charlotte Observer reported that with the cost of single-family homes rising, builders across the region are leaning toward building homes designed to rent, not to own. The paper reports over 5,300 build-to-rent homes are under construction right now in the Concord, Charlotte-Gastonia metro, making us the fourth largest market for that type of construction in the nation. But rents are also high. Will these homes to rent help the situation, hurt the situation? What's your take?
My take is there's always going to be winners and losers. I think that there's going to be winners, and it's going to help property owners, which is part of the reason it's so attractive to build to rent. You maintain the property that is increasing in value astronomically in our city. Unfortunately, this removes opportunities for people who want to come and invest in our city and really make a home out of our city to be able to do so. So those are the things that we've got to think about as we invest this $100 million in our housing bond. How do we create more homeowners?
And with that, I have to stop. I had a question about economic development. If we're going to build more homes for rent, what does that mean about our cost of living here? And is our cost of living hurting future growth? But we don't have time for that. Ed Driggs with us, along with Dimple Ajmera, Victoria Watlington, Malcolm Graham, four chairs of key committees on Charlotte City Council. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.